Chapter 38 Looking in the Landscape. Antiquarian, lawyer, and physician William Stukeley, 1687 to 1765, was obsessed with the stone circles at Stonehenge in southern England. He had a joyous attitude to life and an insatiable curiosity about the past. He was absurd, ingenious, and playful. In 1723, Stukeley and his patron, Lord Winchelsea, walked around the top of the Stonehenge Trilithons, two upright stones supporting a lintel, a third stone that bridges them. They then had dinner on top of one of them. Stukeley was to remark that someone with a steady head and nimble heels would have space to dance a minuet up there. For all his antics, Stukeley was a serious scholar who was interested in ancient people. He thought of Stonehenge not merely as a wonder, but as a sacred place within a wider setting. He completed the first survey of the stone circles and dug into a few nearby burial mounds. But most importantly, he walked the landscape. His perceptive eye spotted long-forgotten earthworks, including what he called an avenue marked by banks and ditches. 2 centuries later, aerial photographs traced this about 3 kilometers to the River Avon, near the town of Amesbury. Stukeley also found a pair of parallel ditches marking out what he believed to have been a race course, and which he dubbed the Cursus, complete with an earthen grandstand at the eastern end. William Stukeley's fieldwork was remarkable for its perception and accuracy. Earlier visitors had done little more than describe Stonehenge in a few words. By walking the countryside, Stukeley founded one of the basic approaches of today's archaeology, the systematic study of ancient landscapes. Archaeologists have always been obsessed with big, conspicuous monuments. And until recently, in the case of Stonehenge, research mirrored this preoccupation. Excavations within and around the stone circles yielded a provisional, not final, chronology, together with lots of speculation about the site's significance. Only in the past few years have investigators raised their eyes, as Stukeley did, and looked properly at the surrounding landscape. While Stukeley traversed the countryside on foot or on horseback, today's archaeologists examine the landscape electronically and from space. For generations, we have dreamed of ways to explore sites without the backbreaking and expensive effort of excavating them. Non-intrusive archaeology, commonly known as remote sensing, studies sites and their surroundings without disturbing them or destroying them by digging them up. Remote sensing began with aerial photography, which became a serious archaeological tool after the First World War. Nowadays, we have Google Earth, satellite imagery, airborne radar, and technologies like ground-penetrating radar and other techniques to peer beneath the Earth's surface. These allow us to explore entire landscapes. Some of the best archaeologists in the business no longer really want to dig. They know that excavation destroys archaeological sites. Of course, selective excavation is necessary to provide dating evidence or to answer specific questions. But today's digs are smaller, slow-moving, and carefully planned, a far cry from Leonard Woolley at Ur in the 1920s and 1930s. Thanks to radiocarbon dating and limited excavations, we know a great deal more than Stukeley about Stonehenge. The great stone circles were erected in about 2500 BC, though there was ritual activity there at least 1,000 years earlier. But we have always been more interested in the stone circles themselves than in the surrounding landscape. This is the story of what we learned about Stonehenge when remote sensing came into play. Vincent Gaffney is an expert on remote sensing who pioneered work on Doggerland, the buried Ice Age landscape under the North Sea. See Chapter 40. He embarked on a 4-year study of Stonehenge in 2010 using magnetometers and ground-penetrating radar to produce 3-dimensional images of sites under the surface. His team employed the latest technology, mounted on quad bikes and mini-tractors, to map 14 square kilometers of the landscape surrounding Stonehenge. The project has revealed 15 hitherto unknown stone circles, burial mounds, ditches, and pits. It turns out that Stonehenge lay in an elaborate and crowded landscape inhabited by the living and the dead. Gaffney examined Stukely's cursus just north of Stonehenge, a long strip marked by ditches, which runs east to west for just over 3 kilometers. Far from being a racecourse, as Stukely had believed, the cursus was probably laid out as a sacred walkway, several centuries before construction work began at Stonehenge. Gaffney and his colleagues found several gaps in the ditches. These may have been channels to guide people arriving from north and south onto the east-west axis. All kinds of mysterious features found in the Gaffney survey await excavation. We do know that many of these features line up, with sunrise on the longest and shortest days of the year, the so-called summer and winter solstices. The Stonehenge landscape had intense spiritual meaning. What it meant to those who built its stone circles and earthworks, and what emotions the dramatic sight of Stonehenge stirred in them, must remain a matter of speculation. But there are some questions that we may now be able to answer. The farmers who built Stonehenge lived in a tough environment, and the passage of the seasons governed their lives. The eternal cycles of planting, growth, and harvest, of symbolic life and death, repeated themselves endlessly through good years and bad. These were the realities that governed human life in the Stonehenge landscape, as they did in many other communities, large and small, including Çatalhöyük in Turkey. See Chapter 37. Fortunately, excavations at Durrington Walls, an earthwork just over 3 kilometers northeast of Stonehenge, have unraveled some of the complex rituals of ancient life there. Durrington Walls is a great circular earthwork, commonly known as a henge. It was once more than 3 meters high and had a 3-meter ditch on the inner side. The earthwork covers 17 hectares, but there is little to see on the surface today. Next to it, on its south side, once stood a timber circle known as Woodhenge. 2 Stonehenge-sized timber circles, known as the North Circle and the South Circle, stood inside the earthwork. Between about 2525 and 2470 BC, before the earthwork was built, one of the largest human settlements in Europe flourished here. As many as 4,000 people lived in about 1,000 houses with wattle and daub walls, wooden strips plastered with mud. The inhabitants may have been those people who built both Durrington Walls and Stonehenge. There are no signs of a builder's village near the latter. Until recently, everyone assumed that the two sites were built at different times, Durrington Walls being a few centuries earlier. However, fresh radiocarbon dates show that the two were in use at the same time. But why was Stonehenge built of stone, while Durrington Walls and Woodhenge were constructed of timber? The lintels of Stonehenge's trilithons have joints similar to those found in wooden structures, hinting that the builders were also carpenters. Michael Parker Pearson is an English archaeologist with very broad experience. Among other places, he has worked in Madagascar, where he visited many tombs and standing stones with Malagasy archaeologist Ramlosonina. Parker Pearson had excavated at Avebury and Stonehenge and arranged for Ramlosonina to visit the sites. Ramlosonina took one look at them and declared that Stonehenge, made in stone, was for the ancestors, the dead, while Durrington Walls, with its wooden uprights, was for the living. Could this have been the case? There were, after all, cremation burials at Stonehenge and burial mounds nearby, but none at Durrington Walls. Parker Pearson and his team work with huge quantities of data. They like to take a broad perspective. Why, for example, had the famous blue stones at Stonehenge been transported all the way from the Preseli Hills in Wales, about 290 kilometers from the stone circles? Perhaps even more importantly, why was Stonehenge erected where it was, nearly 2 kilometers from the nearest water, on top of a rather desolate ridge? And why go to all the trouble of transporting stone and fashioning it to form a stone circle that imitated wood? Teamwork was the only way to address these complex questions. Parker Pearson and some of his archaeologist friends assembled a talented research group for a multi-year Stonehenge Riverside project. Every stage of the work was carefully debated. Thorny questions were thrashed out in the field, in the pub, and in the laboratory. What followed was a carefully organized series of excavations and surveys, combined with analysis of even the smallest artifacts. At Durrington Walls, the excavators traced a surfaced avenue about 100 meters across, with parallel banks that led from the south entrance of the earthwork down to the River Avon. The avenue was aligned with the entrance to the South Circle. How did this fit into the wider Stonehenge landscape? One of the team, Christopher Tilley, had previously developed a new approach to exploring prehistoric landscapes called phenomenology. This involves trying to move through landscapes in the same way as ancient people would have. Ground-penetrating radar, maps, and other well-established survey devices are all well and good, but there is more to a landscape than that. For a start, the researcher has to ignore modern roads, fields, hedges, and paths. How, for example, did the builders of Stonehenge use the natural landscape to approach the stone circles? Tilley walked the avenue and other ancient features and explored the course of the River Avon, since these were canoe-using societies that covered long distances by river and stream. While Tilley went to work, Parker Pearson and his team excavated at Durrington Walls. They stripped off the topsoil of their trenches mechanically, exposing the chalk. One house with a chalk floor measured about 25 square meters. Painstaking manual excavation exposed the stake holes where the clay-plastered walls had once stood. Between the wall and the edge of the chalk floor, the team uncovered shallow grooves that had once held the foundations of box beds and storage bins. The soil on the surface of the floor of five dwellings was sifted through very fine screens in the laboratory. We cannot understand Durrington Walls without looking at Stonehenge, about which we now know a great deal. For a long time, Stonehenge served as a burial place. Its builders constructed it at the end of a natural geological feature that extended along the axis of the solstice. The first version of Stonehenge was built in 3000 BC. The second stage of construction, when the trilithons and sarsen stones, made of sandstone, were erected, came in about 2500 BC, just as comparable timber circles were being constructed at Durrington Walls. Those were erected in a settlement that housed people who had come from afar, with their herds for seasonal feasting in summer and winter. Most likely, Stonehenge was the place of the dead. Durrington Walls was for the living. We know this from the alignment of the two sites. The surrounding landscape was almost like a giant astronomical observatory. At midsummer, Stonehenge lines up with the sun as it appears at sunrise. The Durrington Walls Avenue and the site's southern circle align with the midsummer sun as it dips below the horizon at sunset. The Stonehenge Riverside Project is a wonderful example of close-knit team research that works on carefully defined hypotheses and objectives. The experts on the team come from a broad range of specialties, some of them far removed from archaeology. The team members take risks, ask bold questions, and show an awareness that knowledge is cumulative. It is built up gradually. As such, the project provides a blueprint for achieving a close understanding of Stonehenge in the future. In many respects, the archaeologists working in the Stonehenge landscape represent the future of archaeology. Instead of just excavating individual sites, we regard them as part of much larger landscapes. We have come full circle, back to what William Stukeley was doing at Stonehenge in the 1720s.